for WFHB in Bloomington, this is Hereabouts,
a collaboration with the IU Asian Culture Center.
Welcome to Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced by WFHB and Indiana University's Asian Culture Center. We ask critical questions about identity, culture, community, and shared assumptions. This is your host for the episode, Joyce Lam, and Hereabouts will begin the new year featuring activists in alignment of our two-part civil rights series for the theme this January. This is part one. In this episode, we will have an interview with Karina Wang, conducted by Kayla Mayshing Garvin.
Hi, this is Kayla Mayshing Garvin, and you're listening to Hereabouts. I'm here with Professor Karina Wang of the IU Maurer School of Law. And this month's theme is civil rights. We're here to talk about activism and a bunch of other stuff. So welcome, Karina. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So I wanted to start with sort of a basic overview of what you do at the university and beyond, and sort of what activism you're doing at the moment.
Sure. So starting with what I do at the law school, I'm a clinical professor. That means that I teach second and third year law students how to work with real clients. So doing the actual lawyering on behalf of clients with real legal problems. The practice areas that I'm in are primarily poverty law as the overarching view. That's people who are too poor to afford lawyers and have to deal with the effects of poverty in their day-to-day lives. So I specialize more in disability rights from a poverty perspective, how we can get benefits, mostly monetary or in-kind services, to people who have disabilities, but also how to get them respect and a better sense of belonging and welcomeness within the broader community. And I also do community lawyering, which means that I am working to make lawyers an equal partner in the community, not to come to their clients as the expert who tells them what to do in every aspect of lives, but who recognizes that clients have power and expertise and helps them to build those factors in their own lives. We partner with community organizations that serve clients in order to help them serve their clients and to help their clients better.
What are sort of your methods for encouraging best practices with your students in that arena of community law?
So they are students who are enrolling in a clinical course. It's called the Community Legal and Disability Law Clinics. They are here for one semester, although they can stay on for additional independent work. And there's a classroom component and then a fieldwork component. And in the classroom, we are doing a combination of background reading, theory, and practice. So they are practicing in the classroom the ideas that I want them to put into practice with their clients. And there are ideas that I hope will help them serve their clients better, whether or not they go on to work with the clientele of these clinics or anyone else. My goal really is for lawyers to think of clients as equals. Like I said, think of them as empowered individuals. For example, when I've been doing disability benefits work, a lot of lawyers think of people with disabilities as victims. Something has happened to them. They have a medical or a psychiatric problem, and they are now broken in some respect. So they want to help the clients through more of a sense of sympathy or pity rather than empathy. And there's a sense that we're going to fix the situation somehow. We're not going to fix it. The benefits that we can provide people are still not going to be enough for them to have a comfortable lifestyle, a better lifestyle perhaps than they had before, given how poor our clients are. But not even out of poverty, usually. What we're trying to do is to give them a place where they are heard and treated with respect and are seen essentially as the protagonists in their own narratives, that they have a story, that these things are going on, that their disability may have happened to them or maybe part of them, but it's their choice and how they present it and fit it within the legal framework. So trying not to impose a legal structure on them, but to help them speak in their own voices within the legal structure.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's also so in line with what work is being done within the disability community as well, this sense of like independence, independent living being sort of like a big touchstone in that community.
Right. Well, one of the projects we're really excited to be getting involved in this coming semester is working with adults who have disabilities and are potentially considered incompetent, so not able to take care of their own basic needs, financial matters, and so on. Right now, the presumption is you're incompetent or you're not. And if you're incompetent, you need to have a guardian who can make all of those decisions for you. And Indiana Supreme Court has gotten involved with the project to help develop and support a process called supported decision making so that a person who is considered potentially incompetent will be investigated through the courts to see whether they in fact have the ability to make decisions on their own with the right supports. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not to say it's, you know, on off, you are competent or you're not, but there is a large gray area where with help, you can in fact exercise your own autonomy.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. We were talking earlier too about how sort of the opioid crisis is affecting poverty law within the community. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Well, it's
it's a big one.
It's everywhere. I would say just in my own little sphere from a couple of different perspectives. So one of the primary benefits programs that we work with is Social Security Disability Benefits. And back when I started as a lawyer over about 30 years ago, addiction and addictive behavior were considered disabilities as they are under the psychiatric diagnoses. And I think the 1990s, it changed so that they are still obviously psychiatric disorders, but are not considered disabling for the purpose of Social Security disability. You know, it's one of those who is deserving of governmental help. So the stigma has increased even within this program.
Wow.
And it's that particular prohibition that you cannot get disability benefits specifically because you have an addiction still exists.
Yeah.
That's harder. That's obviously much harder now with so many people who are suffering from this medical problem. Since we cannot directly help people with disability benefits, we're trying to help in other ways. One of the projects we're hoping to become involved in is with Indiana Legal Services and the Opioid Recovery Alliance here in Bloomington to at some point help people who are recovering from their addictions to regain specialized driving privileges.
Oh.
Okay. So, you know, very often you get caught with some illegal substances or you were driving while intoxicated, something like that. One of the things that can happen to you as part of the criminal process is you lose your license, your driver's license. But you're in Indiana. If you don't have your driver's license, you are severely limited in what you can do.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to work, whether it's going to your medical appointments, whether it's seeing your children, if you've lost custody of your children. So if we can start helping this group get back their driving privileges only for the time being to be able to do those specific tasks, then they get some piece of their life back. The other piece, again, is supported guardianship and a supported decision making for people who might otherwise have guardianships. Again, just because you have these particular disabilities does not mean you're incompetent or completely incapable of taking care of yourself. So again, trying to give them back some control in their lives when addiction is so much about losing control to this substance is part of what we're trying to do.
Wow. That's such important work. And unfortunately, such a pervasive problem that we're sort of facing nationwide and worldwide. But I feel like it's a problem that certainly on the rise, or hopefully will be at least addressed in some sort of fashion in the near future. But it seems like such a large problem that hearing about specific things that are actionable is really encouraging.
Well, I think that's what activism really is about. It's about finding hope and finding agency. Mm. Like if you look at the opioid crisis, you say, oh my gosh, it's too big. There's no way that I can do anything to make a difference. So I'm not going to do anything about it.
Right.
But if you can break it down and figure out what skills you have or where there is something very concrete you can do, it becomes a manageable situation. And you're not working on your own, but you are exercising your agency and your hope on behalf of some cause that you believe in or care about, and that hopefully spreads out.
Yeah, I love that.
You are currently listening to Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio on WFHB. This is part one of our January Civil Rights series. Today, we have Karina Wang. Wang is a professor at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law, where she teaches her disability law clinic course. She graduated from Yale University and received her Juris Doctor at New York University. On this episode, Wang is speaking about her current and past experiences in activism, in addition to current social issues like poverty, domestic abuse, and the model minority stereotype.
How did you sort of get involved in this type of activist work? Has this always been something you're interested in?
So I am a half generation, I call myself. My parents came to the United States from Taiwan in the 1960s as part of the brain drain when the immigration laws changed away from country quotas to family reunification and so on. So we came when my father was a graduate student. My parents came totally because they wanted more financial security and a better lifestyle for us, their kids. And that, I would really say, is what drives me. I would not say we were impoverished growing up. We were lucky. And my dad had good work. So I don't think we were always conscious of being in need. But that sense of financial insecurity was always there and was always a driver. So, for example, I tell my students this too. My mother knew of three professions at the time, and they were doctor, lawyer, and engineer, and she had three children. So each one of us was supposed to become one of those professionals. And it was my job to become the doctor, which worked until I hit freshman chemistry in college. And I called my mother and said, okay, that's it. I will finish out the semester, but I'm not going to medical school. And that kind of also made me think, you know, I'm not really cut out for engineering either. That left me with lawyering. That's not the way you should become a lawyer at all. But once I got to law school, I was thinking, okay, what I want to do is civil rights. You know, watching my dad go through the experiences of the bamboo ceiling and so on at his workplace made me think I want to do civil rights. But at the end of my first summer, I was at New York University School of Law in New York City. I was fortunate enough to work with the Legal Aid Society of New York, and that's the primary poor person's law firm in the city. And I was in the Spanish Harlem neighborhood office working on primarily eviction defense. And I realized that for all of my clients, the financial insecurity was more important. Their race, their gender, their sexual orientation all played a huge part in how they managed and were placed into those positions of poverty. But they first really sort of wanted that kind of baseline security. And so I turned more into a poverty lawyer. I don't leave behind the race issues, the cultural issues, but I am interested in working more or less one-on-one with people who are poor and helping them to feel some sense of agency and hope. And that's where I became an activist. It was also in law school that I started doing more with Asian American activism. I had not lived in places with a large Asian American population of any size until I got to law school. That was actually one of the reasons I chose New York City to go to. And it was just easier, frankly, to become aware of and active in Asian American issues. So I actually became involved with the New York Asian Women's Center, which was a domestic violence program geared towards Asian American women in particular. And it was partly a way for me to be giving back specifically to the Asian American community. It was partly a way to be working with women. It was partly a way at that time to try to keep up some of my language fluency, which has only decreased in the decades since, unfortunately. But it was just wonderful. It was a way of belonging as an Asian American in the U.S. in a way I hadn't had previously.
Oh, that's so cool. I was struck by what you said about people experiencing the world through poverty first, as opposed to any of these other sort of like identifying factors that we sort of societally pinpoint. It's always striking to me that I feel like people have a reticence to discuss class in America, like, oh, we're good, when that actually really is not the case. And the ways in which that poverty affects all aspects of people's lives is really quite striking. I'm also curious about your work in that activist realm with these organizations in New York City. Was that something that you also got involved in through the law school, or was that independent of your program?
I think it probably came up tangentially through law school. It was not part of the legal program because at the time, the New York Asian Women's Center did not have any kind of legal programming specifically, and they could be non-legal advocates, but I was primarily a social service volunteer at that point, staffing their crisis hotline, working with women and children in shelters. We actually organized an English conversation class that was a lot of fun, and eventually becoming a safe home as well for women who needed a safe place to stay as they were fleeing their abusers. So the work I was doing was non-legal in the expertise sense, but was, I think, incredibly important to my development as a lawyer.
Yeah.
Because I was coming as just a community member. I wasn't holding myself out as having any kind of special knowledge. And what they taught me was how to do that, and how not to be sort of this arrogant expert from the law school coming in. I was one more Asian American woman trying to put a finger in this dike of domestic violence. And that's been very, very important to how I lawyer with my clients and how I teach my students to be lawyers with their clients.
Yeah, it does seem sort of central to what we've been talking about earlier, that it's about being a partner rather than being a savior, as it were.
Right. Well, and in domestic violence advocacy in particular, because the problem, shall we say, is the lack of control, that the person experiencing abuse has no control over their own lives. Very much the process of providing services is empowerment. Mm. It can be kind of amazing and frightening to people who aren't trained within this type of advocacy. And that includes most lawyers, actually. But the sense like, well, how can you let this person make choices that are clearly dangerous? Like getting involved with another person who also turns out to be abusive, right? I had lawyer colleagues who would be appalled at those kinds of advocacy choices, where you're saying, but it is her life. We have to let her lead it. We have to give her tools. We have to give her support. But she ultimately does have to decide who she wants to be partners with and when she is able to leave or when she is able to stay. So that informs how I lawyer now.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to control my clients. I'm trying to give them tools to help them find their own path.
Yeah.
You are currently listening to Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio on WFHB. This is part one of our January Civil Rights series. Today, we have Karina Wang. Wang is a professor at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law, where she teaches her disability law clinic course. She graduated from Yale University and received her Juris Doctor at New York University. On this episode, Wang is speaking about her current and past experiences in activism, in addition to current social issues like poverty, domestic abuse, and the model minority stereotype.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit and sort of talk about broader picture civil rights and how that interacts with the law. And in particular with, since this is our Asian American hour, in particular in the Asian American Pacific Islander community, how civil rights and the law are interrelated, especially within these fields of activism that we've been talking about. How can we, within our community, continue to advocate for civil rights, and what areas do you sort of see as being hot points here as we're wrapping up 2018 and coming into a new year, 2019?
Right. I think a lot of it right now for Asian Americans is finding and exercising their political power as a way of enforcing access to other civil rights. And that is partly then, again, about finding our own voices, our own causes. So much of what happens in the U.S. is that the dominant culture imposes strictures, boundaries on who we are and what our identities are. So I think the terms have changed a bit for Asian Americans, but when I was in law school, it was, of course, the model minority,
right,
that all of us who were coming over from Asia were either going to be amazing medical doctors or child prodigy violinists, you know.
Ever-present.
Ever-present, and just sort of by virtue of being Asian, as opposed to understanding some of the structural effects, like, yeah, I remember the 1960s and so on, what was happening was the brain drain. Mm. There was a reason, perhaps, that the early immigrants coming in larger numbers from Asia had so much drive. And I'm not saying that other later immigration waves did not have that drive, but when you are coming over with higher education or the desire to get higher education, we see that over and over again in the U.S. too, you're going to do better. Your kids will do better because they have the benefit of your education and your drive and your parents' drive. So that translates into greater opportunities for the kids.
Where you say exercising political power, can you unpack that a little bit? What does that mean in terms of like either individual action or community action? Does that mean voting? Does that mean putting more candidates on the ballot? Does that mean something completely different?
Sort of all of the above. We all should be voting just because that is our basic civil right. Yeah. And I'm not saying who you should vote for, but you should be voting. You should not be not voting. You should not be sitting on the sidelines. And because that is the one place that we are given a lot of voice.
Yeah.
And if we don't use it, we lose it. And those individual voices add up eventually. In terms of community action, it's if you want a certain outcome, you have to join with other people. Voting by itself in a vacuum doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So it's finding a place that matters to you and working on it. I would say, in a somewhat controversial way, let's say. Like, if you think about the Asian Americans who have sued Harvard over their admissions practices, they are choosing to exercise their political voice. It happens not to be an outcome that I agree with.
Right.
Okay, but they are doing what we all should be doing. And they have, in some ways, also mobilized the opposite Asian voice, which is important. So we need to be doing that. I think on the progressive side, and this is not just of Asian Americans, we are not necessarily as organized sometimes.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what we need to learn in terms of being politically active. It is always hard, though, to remain involved and active when there isn't any major issue affecting us. And when you are told your role is a model minority, you really have to unpack what that means to realize, oh, that's not a compliment.
No.
That's a tool to divide even farther.
Yeah.
And to fight back against the system. So you have to be aware of the systematic issues that are going on and how you're going to deal with them. And it's like for me, when I talk about poverty, I don't want to say that I'm not aware of all of the structural and long racialized histories of the United States that have made people of color poorer across the board than white people. And I'm not saying that there aren't white people who are poor also. It's just that I have chosen as an activist to work on the one-on-one, the individual people pieces, because that's what I think I do better and what brings me the most joy. I applaud the people who are working on the systemic issues. Activism is the same way. It's just important to be that pebble, finding your place to cause some ripples, join up with other pebbles, and so on. It's political and personal. What do you care about? There may be an Asian American aspect to it that will make you feel about it more immediately, or to react to it in a way that otherwise might feel disproportionate, but go with it. And if not, that's also great. Part of being an Asian American activist is joining in causes that are not just Asian American pigeonholes. That's where we belong. If we feel that we can be active only in traditional Asian American spheres, then we're again buying into the structures and the restrictions that the dominant society has placed on us.
No, that's so good. That's so, oh my gosh, I feel that. You had mentioned sort of in passing this case. I have it here. Let me pull up what the actual case is. Harvard case that we're looking at right now. This is sort of speculative. I think when this episode airs, they'll either be making the decision or will have just made the decision or will be presenting it to the Supreme Court. Not totally sure about the timeline, but it will be in the news in January when this episode airs. So yeah, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to what this case sort of means within the educational sense and what it might mean for the nation at large, this case against Harvard brought by Asian American students for fair admission.
So this goes back to some of my interest in law and psychology, law and social work. Not trained in either of those areas. What I like about them is they give me a way of thinking about how to use law better, both as a tool to represent people, which is the kind of teaching that I do, and as a tool to make law itself more responsive to the realities of the world. So affirmative action in a lot of race-based jurisprudence stems from this idea that it's good to be colorblind, to think that we are all the same, that we don't have individual differences based on race as a social construct or our genders and so on. And that's where the anti-affirmative action pieces come in. It doesn't look at how we as human beings actually respond to people who are different from us in some way, that whole sense of a very small group. So if schools aren't able to use race and other cultural factors in making up their student enrollment, we're just ending up replicating it. I mean, we need affirmative tools to undo the decades of affirmative action for the privileged groups. Like the alumni and the athletes. Especially the alumni at these schools,
Yeah, the legacy sort of policies in place.
The thing is that when you're working from a colorblind perspective, you aren't thinking of alumni legacies and athletes as affirmative action. It was always affirmative action in favor of those groups. It is de-affirming them in favor of affirming other people to say, yes, you matter as much to our community as the athletes and the legacies that we've brought in. It is in some ways, therefore, similar to the whole Black Lives Matter piece. Mm-hmm. When people say, no, it's not Black Lives Matter, it's all lives matter, they're forgetting that because all lives matter, Black lives matter too, or should yes. matter too.
Yeah.
And so affirmative action is saying, yes, we all need education here. Mm-hmm. And we are all enriched by having a diverse student body, not just based on race, but a whole bunch of different cultural and personal identity factors. So if we have this imbalance through decades of preferential treatment towards certain groups, the only way to rebalance or reintegrate the pool is to make special efforts, affirmative action, towards the groups that have been left out. And so if we understand this from a psychological perspective, which a lot of what Grutter v. Bollinger worked on, that was the Michigan case, right. The last big affirmative action case, then I think our jurisprudence would eventually change to accept the basic psychological, social, cultural pieces of humanity, of human beings, and allow us to interfere again in a different way in our admissions process to get a society in the schools that will produce better citizens once yeah. they graduate. And I mean, even now, the affirmative action cases that exist are trying to get beyond what we used to call critical mass, right? I mean, it's not enough to get people of color in this particular context in if they don't feel that they belong, that they're there as second-class citizens or third-class citizens. So in some ways, if you have enough second- or third-class citizens, we have a sense of equality and belonging. We're all there because we have a right to be there.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's so true, though. The idea of sort of preparing a space for the people who are coming in and making sure that it's ready can in some form be achieved by just having a lot of the people, and then in a few years, things will sort of hopefully even out.
Right. Well, we have to, because we all, like when we hire people who are like us. Mm-hmm. So if you think about like orchestras,
right?
What they did was they were realizing they hire people who look like them. So when the elite musicians were all white men, they hired white men.
Right.
When they hid who the performer was behind a screen and listened only to the music, they started hiring more women. Mm. This is how our brains work. So if we can recognize how our brains work and take structural steps to change, to fool our brains for that moment, to fight right. that implicit bias, then we end up with a more mixed pool. And as more women or more people of color join the group that is elite, and not necessarily elite because of just education, but in whatever context we're talking about, then they will be bringing in more people who look like them as well, or more people who are different from them because there's so many choices.
Yeah.
And that might actually get us a more diverse community that has a sense of belonging.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been so great. I feel like I learned so much in this time, and I'm so glad I got the chance to sit down with you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It was my pleasure as well.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been Hereabouts. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Hereabouts.
Hereabouts is produced with the IU Asian Culture Center and broadcast from WFHB in Bloomington. Our theme music is by Eternal Youth.
Tune in to Hereabouts every other week from 5:30 to 6 on Wednesdays right here on WFHB.